Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. This doesn't sound great, I know, but everything is an economic story. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 26th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I think I've mentioned this before. There's a thing that happens when we're putting this program together after something like the massacre in Uvalde happens, where we know there is a marketplace story to cover, but honestly, the story itself, 21 people being killed, most of them kids, that story is so horrible that we don't want to be tone deaf, I guess. We want to be aware. Talked about that yesterday a little bit, that guns are a business and that we have to talk about that. And today, that these school shootings, and also the school shootings we don't hear about, they have real economic effects, and we have to talk about that, too. Hannes Schwandt is a health economist at Northwestern University who, along with his co-authors, studied the impact of gun violence at schools on survivors' economic lives. Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's break this down then into two categories of effect, right, which you talk about in this paper, short-term and long-term. In the short-term, the first months and years after school violence, school shooting, what happens? What do you find?
So we find that students who witness shootings are more likely to be chronically absent and also be more likely to be held back in the grades for 2 years after the event. And what's important here is that the shootings that we study in the context of Texas actually are shootings that are not as deadly as the current mass shootings or other mass shootings that are receive a lot of publicity in the media. But we are looking at shootings that have not more than one death, and in some cases, no fatality at all. And we find that even though these are less deadly shootings, they have these very strong impacts on students who witness that shooting.
What I hear you saying then is that the mass shootings are terrible and have horrible lasting effects. The everyday gun violence in schools also has effects, even though we don't hear about them and we don't read about them that much.
Exactly. So we talked about the short run, but we also find we are able in our data to follow students over a longer time period. And we see long-term educational and economic negative impacts. So we see that, students witnessing a shooting, they're less likely to graduate from high school, they're less likely to go to college. And once they enter the labor market, we find they're less likely to be employed, and that they also have lower earnings in their mid-20s. That's like the oldest age that we can, mm-hmm. we can see them. And overall, when we make a calculation, what do these earnings effects imply in terms of lost lifetime income, right? Given that they seem to be very persistent, we calculate that over the course of a lifetime, the exposure to a shooting leads to a loss of almost $120,000 in lifetime income.
If you could get all 100 members of the United States Senate in a room, Professor, what would you tell them about your research and what might be best for the economic outcomes regarding gun violence in schools?
So I guess the first important aspect is that the current resources devoted to school shooting survivors, so those who have witnessed a school shooting, they're not sufficient to buffer against the educational economic losses. Mental health in general is very important for people's economic productivity. It's often more important actually than physical health. So that's one important issue. The other important issue is, of course, we have to try to prevent also mass shootings. Of course, that's the very first priority. but or even like the shootings that are less deadly, right, that might not even be really on the radar of the public debate, even those shootings can be very harmful.
So, look, speaking about mental health, actually, and I'm going to ask you a personal question here, and you can tell me to go pound sand if you want to, but you're a trained economist, you study human development and social policy, and you do this very difficult research. And I guess I wonder what your reaction was when you heard the news out of Uvalde, Texas the other day.
I think my first reaction is just like, you know, everybody, it's just like, regardless of the research that you're doing, it's just like speechless, right? Being speechless and being so horrified. And I have a 1.5-year-old myself now, just thinking that like your children could be in that situation, could be murdered, could witness the murder. I mean, it's just like leaves you speechless and so sad. And of course, you know, then you get requests like this ones from the media to talk about that. And I think it's very difficult. And then, of course, you know, at the same time, you think like, okay, we have been working on this because we think it is important and it is tragic and we need to analyze more what it actually means and, you know, and then what are the full costs of those events, right? You know, to quantify the harms that are done and the damages and the scars left in those children.
Well, I appreciate you taking our call anyway, Professor. That's Hannes Schwandt. He's an assistant professor of human development, also social policy at Northwestern. Professor, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
We learned earlier this week that new home sales in this economy have kind of rolled over, down 17% March to April. Today, pending home sales down 3.9% last month. That's according to the National Association of Realtors and is the sixth consecutive monthly drop. And as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, this is all evidence that the Fed raising rates is doing what it is supposed to do.
How much you pay for a mortgage is mostly determined by principal and interest, and both have been going up for new home buyers as home prices and mortgage rates have soared this year, says Mike Fratantoni at the Mortgage Bankers Association.
The median mortgage payment in April was up to $1,889.
He said that's an increase of 8.8%, which at first I thought he meant year to year, but he corrected me, that's just since March.
It was up 43% compared to last year at this time and up 32% just through the course of 2022.
This is housing inflation on steroids.
Well, it is a big shock.
That's Guy Sakala at trade publication Inside Mortgage Finance.
You know, we started off the year with sub 4% mortgage rates, and we're now up to about 5%, which is about the sharpest jump anybody's seen in a decade or so.
The other thing that's making buying a home less affordable is home prices, up by double digits since last year and far outpacing income gains, says Daniel McHugh at Harvard's Joint Center for Housing Studies. He points to those numbers from the Mortgage Bankers Association that we started with. A year ago, the median monthly payment for a new mortgage was around $1,300. Now it's close to $1,900.
Which means, you know, under standard lending terms, a household would have to earn over $100,000 to afford payments on the median priced home. That's up from about $80,000 a year ago.
And the median household income in America, he points out, is around $70,000. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
$22. That is the new minimum starting hourly wage at Apple. The company said today it's increasing its overall compensation budget. Target did something similar back in February, all of which tracks because wages are still rising in this economy as companies are feeling the pressure of that tight labor market. Now, how long that pressure might last? Well, that's the question, isn't it? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
Competition over workers is driving up wages in this economy, and employees know it.
49% of people believe that they could make more money just by switching jobs right now.
Allie Kelly is with Employ, which makes recruiting and hiring software.
32% of workers feel comfortable quitting a job without having another lined up.
That is a lot of confidence, and it is well-placed. There are two job openings for every unemployed person, according to the most recent data. And wages, from mining to finance, have been rising fast.
But they are the fastest in anything that you can't work remotely.
Dana Peterson is with the Conference Board. Think healthcare, think waiters, think in-person retail. And in a world of remote work, it is the in-person jobs that are hardest to fill. And a lot of people have switched out of those since the pandemic began.
If you're moving out of your restaurant job and then finding a tech job, you could see wages increase in both sectors, right? The tech job, they're offering a higher wage to attract you, and the retail job, they're hiking the wage to place you.
Now, of course, this is all happening at a time of historic inflation. Wages have grown 5% over the past year. Prices have risen 8%, wiping out gains for workers and raising costs for businesses. Michael Pierce is senior U.S. economist at Capital Economics. He says there are signs of relief.
In the sectors where shortages emerged soonest, so kind of in leisure and hospitality, we're starting to see some of those signs of shortages beginning to ease.
But there are many reasons for the labor shortage, including not enough younger workers. The Conference Board's Dana Peterson says we are going to be dealing with some level of labor shortage indefinitely. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
A thought about that next batch of birthday party balloons you're going to buy. Once all the helium we've got here on planet Earth is gone, that's it. Ain't no more. And if you're thinking that'll make for some somber birthday parties, I mean, maybe, yeah. But fun aside, the lighter-than-air gas is in especially short supply, and that's not just a problem for your local five-year-old. Healthcare and tech and manufacturing all compete for helium. Science does, too. And as Marketplace's Savannah Marr reports, researchers are at the back of the helium line.
University of New Mexico chemist Karen Smith punches in a code to get into the lab she manages in Albuquerque. Three white cylinders on blue legs are humming away on the far side of the room. They look sort of like 8-foot-tall cousins of R2-D2.
So you're going to want to stay fairly close to the door.
Smith thinks the powerful magnets inside could mess with my recording equipment.
These magnets are donuts of wire. And because they're sitting in liquid helium, they can have a lot of electricity running through them.
These instruments help researchers determine the molecular structure of everything from new medicines to building materials. And they're high maintenance. They need to be kept at about 450 degrees below zero. Smith says liquid helium is the only substance that can make that happen.
It's really cold. Really, really, really cold.
Like the coldest thing on Earth. The other unique thing about helium is that it's extremely light. So when it evaporates from these instruments, it disappears into the atmosphere forever. And lately, Smith says it's not easy to come by.
We have been really lucky so far. Okay, we'll put a sound effect. We'll knock on wood.
Smith is getting about 80% of the helium she needs for these magnets. Other research labs are worse off.
I just said, this is not going to work.
Margaret Eastman is getting about 65% of the helium she needs to maintain magnets at her Oklahoma State University lab. She says it's dangerous for a magnet to sit in just a shallow pool of liquid helium, or none at all.
It's possible that it could be damaged and you may not be able to bring it back to the field again.
That would disrupt a lot of research, and replacing these magnets can cost hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. Most of the helium in the U.S. comes from a federally run plant in Texas, says Phil Kornbluth, president of Kornbluth Helium Consulting. That plant has been offline since January because of understaffing and safety concerns. And the Russian government's plan to open a new plant there this spring didn't exactly pan out.
So instead of getting a large new supply into the market, we got nothing.
Kornbluth says helium is used in everything from MRI machines to manufacturing semiconductor chips and fiber optic cables. And during the shortage, he says suppliers are prioritizing certain critical uses of helium.
Because they are a medical application or a critical infrastructure thing like a nuclear power plant, That means that if you're viewed as less critical,
like if you're a physics or a chemistry lab,
your allocation will be even worse.
For climate researchers, worse allocations mean less helium and fewer weather balloon launches. The National Weather Service has been cutting back on launches since March to conserve the gas. That concerns Sandra Uter, a professor of atmospheric science at North Carolina State University.
We can't go back and get that data later, right? If you don't launch the balloon, then you don't have the data.
To understand and predict climate change, she says researchers need a consistent record of the atmosphere.
Does it have to come from a weather balloon filled with helium? No, but I need to get that profile.
Uter says scientists can't keep relying on the fragile helium market. They have to find other solutions. Back at the University of New Mexico, Karen Smith agrees. She'd love it if there was a powerful magnet out there that could do what she needed it to do without super cold helium.
Everybody would go to that as soon as they could afford to buy them.
But first, somebody needs to invent it. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And that's really big money for these airports.
Big money in airports, always a plus for the traveling public. I guess first, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 516 today, 1.6%, 32,637. The NASDAQ up 305 points, 2.6%, 11,740. The S&P 500 up 79 points, nearly 2%, 4,057. Mitchell was telling us about home affordability. So, of course, we're going to check on some real estate companies. Zillow hammered on nearly 2.5%. Remax Holdings bid up 7.8% today. Sabri was telling us a bit about Apple bumping up starting salaries. Looked at whether other tech companies might follow suit. Apple got a raise of 2.3% today. Microsoft powered up more than 1.25%. Google parent Alphabet found about 1.8% today. Bonds up, yield down. Not by much, though. 2.73% on the 10-year. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. That tight labor market Sabri was reminding us about, where companies are having to compete on wages, that might have something to do with this. Data from the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center that shows undergraduate enrollment this spring is off almost 5% from last year. And since the pandemic started, there are 1.4 million fewer undergrads in school in this economy, which could be an issue for both the American labor force and for higher ed. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Sure, some enrollment declines were to be expected during the height of pandemic disruptions, but now?
You know, we really thought things would be starting to pick up a little bit at this point, particularly because most colleges are now back to in-person classes.
Doug Shapiro heads research at the National Student Clearinghouse. He says enrollments are dropping at a faster rate now, even at some four-year colleges.
So that says that, you know, more students from the middle class are really rethinking, in my view, the need for a bachelor's degree.
There are multiple factors pushing and pulling young people away from college, says Lauren Bauer with the Brookings Institution. On the push side, some continued pandemic weirdness, the high sticker price, and on the pull side,
the labor market has been most hospitable to the youngest workers. You know, the wage returns to being in the labor market right now for young people are off the charts.
But there's no guarantee workers will continue to have the upper hand, and the opportunities for well-paid jobs for workers with college degrees are only likely to increase in the future, says Anthony Carnevale at the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce.
So it doesn't change the facts.
The current shift could, however, change the way higher education operates. As young people get more picky about return on investment, he sees higher ed moving toward more of a training model aimed at preparing students for jobs. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
According to AAA, something on the order of 3 million people are going to get on a commercial airliner this weekend. That is 25% more than a year ago, which makes sense, right? More people vaccinated and boosted, more countries relaxing travel restrictions, and oh my goodness, can you say pent-up demand? And just in time for all those passengers, a whole bunch of major airports, Los Angeles, Seattle, Salt Lake City, and some others, are just or almost newly renovated. There are new runways and aviation technology, of course, and some new terminal designs, too. Marketplace's Kristen Schwab has more on that one from New York City.
After going through security at the new Terminal B at LaGuardia Airport, the first thing you see is a huge fountain. And every 15 minutes, it puts on a show with music and lights and water falling from the ceiling in a pattern that spells out the five boroughs. A bunch of travelers are standing in front of it. And of course, they're filming it.
Actually, the first time I saw it was on Instagram.
Well, that's what we aspire to. We want Instagram moments. We want people to actually feel that the experience has been something that's been positive.
Rick Cotton is the executive director of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, which operates the airport. This fountain reportedly cost $1 million, a pretty penny that's paying off. Last year, LaGuardia won UNESCO's prize for best new airport in the world. This is LaGuardia we're talking about, the airport that used to rank last on passenger satisfaction surveys, the airport that Joe Biden, when he was vice president, controversially likened to a, quote, third world country. Cotton says a big focus of the new LaGuardia is customer experience.
You want people, first of all, to feel more relaxed, to enjoy themselves, and to the extent they do that, they do more shopping. And that's a plus from the point of view of the business of operating the terminal.
Airports haven't traditionally been inspired spaces. You get in, you wait in line, you get your overpriced coffee, and hopefully you get out on time. But David Slotnick at travel website The Points Guy says in the last several years, airports have been investing heavily in public art, natural lighting, and big communal spaces.
I think that there's been more of a design focus and a focus on making airports places that people at best, or at worst, don't mind spending time. And that's really big money for these airports.
A nice terminal might encourage passengers to arrive earlier or choose an airport for a layover. At the very least, it can help calm anxious travelers. And all that encourages them to spend more money. Slotnick says about 40% of airport revenue comes from passenger spending on things like food and shopping. That makes remodeling airport terminals a no-brainer. But actually working out the details of it?
It's complicated because there are just so many stakeholders here.
Think about all the different entities that coexist in airports. They're owned by cities or states, but the federal government regulates and sometimes subsidizes them. There's the FAA and the TSA, and then, of course, the airlines. Ryan Marzullo at Delta Airlines is overseeing the construction of LaGuardia's new Terminal C, which opens next week. He says public-private partnerships are tricky.
There were times during the negotiations where we're ready to walk away because economically it didn't make sense if we couldn't figure out some solutions to some of the obstacles that were being presented.
Delta is covering the majority of Terminal C's $4 billion price tag. It means Delta led the project, not the Port Authority, which is unusual. But still, both sides of the equation needed each other. Port Authority admits financing the project would have been tough without Delta. And Delta needs LaGuardia to beef up its presence in the nation's largest city. New York is one of Delta's major hubs.
At the end of the day, aviation business is a competitive environment. And so we're big on our brand. And that goes from not only the aircraft and the flight crew, but also your ground experience.
But airports that have a market monopoly are investing in new spaces, too. Denver International Airport is the third busiest in the country by passenger volume, with few other big airports in the region. And it's already known for its design, with white rooftop tents that mimic the Rocky Mountains in the distance. Still, it's getting a $1.5 billion makeover. Stuart Williams is the Senior Vice President of Airport Expansion.
Denver International Airport is the gateway to the Rockies. And, you know, we're all kind of working for the Chamber of Commerce unofficially, right?
Because an airport's impact extends way beyond its walls. In New York, I'm Kristen Schwab for Marketplace.
His final note on the way out today. Thanks, Delta Airlines, I guess. Here's today's entry in the Corporate Speak Hall of Fame. The airline said today it is going to strategically decrease its flights this summer, trying to get ahead of demand that it's just not back up to speed operations-wise enough to meet. Delta is going to preemptively cancel about 100 flights a day between July 1st and August 7th. Friendly skies indeed. Yes, wrong airline, I know. Give it to me, will you? Okay, off we go. But here is your moment of economic context, hearkening back to Sabri's story about Apple and other companies raising worker pay in this tight labor market. The Associated Press reported today, based on some analysis that it had had done, worker pay was up 4.4% in 2021, the fastest in 20 years. But as we've been talking about, not enough to keep up with inflation. CEO pay at S&P 500 companies, according to that same analysis, why, yes, up 17%. All right, we got to go. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Amanda Peacher, and Stephanie Seek are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.